when Gretchen Michael said that Elisa Monte was his favorite choreographer, and he had me go to meet her, at some point in our conversation, she said, "Oh, I started my dance company with the intention of exploring dance as a spiritual path." Do you remember that? Did you say that? Right? Because I've been like putting it in the bios and stuff. I thought, oh, of course. But I guess what strikes me most about her is her incredible kindness. It's always fun standing. Hope I'm not embarrassing her, but in sharing this extraordinary and joyful experience of dance, and really being able to bring it to everyone, like of all ages and abilities and experience levels. So I don't know her very well, but I think what we seek to do here on this path, I feel like her path of dance has somehow brought about all those qualities in her that we seek to become. And so I really believe that she can share something of value with us, and how to use the path of dance as part of our spiritual lives. So, okay, welcome.
Changing up the guard or the wire. I don't need, I can just put this in my pocket. Okay. Well, here we are. This is, I have to say, one of my moments that I always look forward to in the year is having the opportunity, finding the opportunity to come visit with this group of people and the practice, because I learned so much and I gained so much. I'm very selfish. I always have been. I've always done what I've wanted to do. So I consider that selfish. But my selfishness, I feel, you know, is my obligation to myself to do the best and be the best person that I possibly can. So I think that's how I look at my selfishness. And I grab upon opportunities to be able to enhance that and to bring my path further and what I'm trying to accomplish, and how do I understand that and how do I even define it. So I always will grab an opportunity to do that, and you are very helpful in that. Thank you. Appreciate that. So I have been asked to come. I'm going to move this because I'm getting warm. Right. It's the sea and wind. It's the sea and wind. On this, because I may take this shirt off too now. Go through it again. Thank you. Okay. So I've been asked to come and do what I really am the worst at. I absolutely hate speaking. That's why I dance. I always wished and hoped I could be a poet, because I absolutely love poetry. But I have no aptitude for words, so I thought, you better move on from that, you know. So I moved. I always moved. I don't know if you guys, when you were children, music would play, and what do you do when music's playing? I danced around the house. I moved furniture around and pushed it aside, and I danced. So, and that's choreography. That's, you know, I think the mind and the body moving to rhythm, whatever form that is, whether it's through instruments or voice or, you know, the wind blowing or the sea, but listening to your own heartbeat, the pulses in your body, you know, wherever you can find the rhythm, you dance to it. And that's what choreography is. And I think being choreography and dance for me are very close in that the body is the instrument that defines the manifestation of the choreography. So the body is the dancer body. And that has to be accessed and motivated. As a child, we move wonderfully anyway. Nothing hurts. Everything is loose. All the joints work. So generally, they're like wonderful dancers with no training at all. And they respond very openly and freely to sounds, music, rhythm. And that's choreography. And I often wondered, what is that? What is that? I know this is a silent retreat, but I think it's a special situation in that we have you and me, and we're not going to have you and me very often. So I think we will want to take a part of this time to have you answer some of my questions and me answer some of your questions if I can. And one of them is that, what is that? That wonderful impulse that we have to move to rhythm. And what is rhythm? Why is it so important? Why does it build vital energy in us and stir it, inspire us to do better, to be better, to move bigger, to be freer? So all of those things I've always confused me. And I am not really that much closer to the answer. I don't know what those things are. I do know that it's what propels me. So anything I've learned in my life, I feel lessons in knowing how to do something or understanding something, or it's always been through my body. Even writing, even reading, I had to have a pencil in my hand and I needed paper, and I needed to do that. It needed to go through my body. Just sitting and wrote through my mind and through speech, it just never did it for me. I never could really get at what the lesson was. So for some reason, I'm trapped seriously within that makeup of things. So hence, I was drawn to choreography and dancing, always. My body always seemed to give me the answers that I sought. When I moved, I was my happiest, my freest. I seemed to understand, now I know why I'm here. I get it now. So for me, it was the quick path to happiness and to understanding the importance of my life and a way of sharing who I was with people, sharing, you know, information, what I could gather. And the body of choreography that I've managed to create over the last 30 years, very often I don't know where the work originated from. So in other words, while I'm in the process of creating it, I often do not know what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. I'm simply following it's an informed impulse is what I want to call it. And I might, months later or a year later, finally go, oh, of course, that's what you were dealing with. That's what you were trying to get at. That's what was inside of you that you were questioning, that was not clear at the moment. And that was my way of processing that vagueness or disconnect from my life at that moment. That was my path to be able to try and get it in the groove. So I don't know. It's interesting. I think, you know, dance and choreography is much like any other art. I think it's like a writer sitting down to write a novel or a poem, or a painter trying to paint a picture. Do you often think, like, if I were a painter, because when I really start to hurt at the end of the day, you know, I think, oh, what can I, maybe I'll become a painter. So I don't have to move so much and it won't hurt that much. And often though, well, what would you paint? I don't know what I would dance. I mean, I don't sit and say, what am I going to dance? Does a writer sit and say, what am I going to write? I once went to a lecture that Elizabeth Allende gave. She was speaking about her work. And I think it was a similar question. There were students in the audience, and they said, well, how do you write? How do you know what to write about? How do you choose that? What is it? I sit down every day, and I write a page. I just sit and write a page. And after a year, I have 365 pages. I have a novel. And when things are going right, you know, when you put the stroke, and you go, ah, and the next stroke just happens, you start to follow the work of art. You no longer are the person doing it. You are not doing it. It's doing it to you. You're following something. And that's the freedom. I think that's what artists get addicted to, is that freedom from themselves. Because I get bored with myself. I've been around a while, and I just like, okay, I know that. I know what you're going to do. It's not a surprise anymore. I get it, you know. So I get bored with myself. So that's such a relief to be able to just leave yourself for a moment and have something else take over where you're not planning every step, putting every step in front of the other. But I think life is like that in general. I mean, that's when your life is going well. It's when you're chasing after it and you're not saying, okay, and what am I doing next? What's next on the list? Okay, cross that out. It's, you know, the list is forming as you're going, and you're going so fast you don't even have time to finish one thing and you're into the next because it's in the flow and something else is taken over. So I think that's what art does for us. That's what it does for me. And sharing it with the performing arts is much more ritualistic than, you know, painting and gallery situations. It becomes more, or isolation of reading a novel yourself or a poem. Performing arts is different. Performing arts, I feel, is really a ritual where you're really, the community is helping you and you're helping the community by that exchange of, it's funny, when I choreograph a piece, I could have spent months with it in the studio with the dancers. You never know if it's a success or not until you've put it in front of an audience. And it's not because they applaud or not. That's not the reason. It's not a barometer of noise level. It just, you know, it's connected to them. You know that it's handing over something that's important to them for that moment, and they're able to get, you know, you've managed to share something important. And you never know until you're actually sharing that moment with an audience. It's funny, in the performing arts. I'm sure it's the same with playwrights and, you know, theater. And it's the same, you just don't know. So that's a good question that I'd like to hear about. That I don't, you know, that's pretty mysterious. So it's a ritual. I was very impressed as a young choreographer. It was, you know, the first sort of happenings of the company. We were beginning to tour different places, and we went to Paris in Europe, and we went to Asia, Indonesia. And I remember going to Paris, and you know, like my company members were like, "You're not particularly nervous." I said, "Well, you know, it's okay. I mean, you were really well trained, and you've done it, and everything's going well, and we're going to do it." And the French are really not into dance. I mean, so their opinion, I wasn't nervous about the French opinion about my work, because they are very intellectual, and they don't always respond to the physicality of something alone. It needs to have an intellectual connection to who they are and what they're doing at the moment and the bigger picture to society. And I am not at all interested in that. My work does not look at that on any level. I am completely non-political. You know, I think, for me, I try and reach people on a more, I try and reach them at their other brain, you know, the lower level brain, not this brain. No, but seriously, I mean, for me, it's a visceral experience that I'm trying to get at and share, because I think, for me, that's how I've learned everything, right, through my body. So, of course, that's the way I want to share what I'm doing, is the way I know how to do it, because that's all you can do is do what you know how to do. And I know we were at a disconnect in that sense, because I know their art, I know their dance. And so, I mean, of course I wanted them to like us, but I wasn't nervous if they didn't. I wouldn't have been like, "Oh, I have to start over," and you know. So for instance, it went well. We got good reviews. It was great. They applauded. Everything went really well. Went to Indonesia and performed later that year. And I was dying. I was a wreck. I was really nervous about my reaction to Indonesians and what they thought of my dance, because I had so much respect for their dance form, which is thousands of years old, totally informed, complicated, multi-leveled. So if I was just sort of a Western, simple, one-sentence thing to them, I was like, I would have to sit back and really sort of consider what I was doing, and the importance of it, and whether it was actually worth doing. But the performances went well. I've gone back to Indonesia many times, and sort of they can see the work, and that means a lot to me because of the depth of their dance world. I was once told, I mean, I was in residence in Bali, actually working with a village there, and I would try and sneak around the island trying to get into more and more closed level dances, because it starts to get very esoteric where it's not for tourists and you have to be initiated. And it's quite beautiful as you go into those layers. And apparently, I'm not sure how many rings there are. I think there were 9. But there's 9 levels of dance there in Bali. It's the outer ring. Starts with, for everyone, tourists, and it's what you see if you go to Bali. And it's gorgeous. It's fabulous. I mean, they're not just doing it inconsequentially and not paying attention. They are trained. They are beautiful. They are exquisite. There's a lot of importance put to the performance and care, and that's the outer ring. But everyone's allowed to see it. And then it goes from there. It goes, you know, to the village and little private ceremonies within the village, celebrating certain things. The innermost circle is just the dancer. No audience. So this is pretty beautiful. I mean, that to me sort of said, oh, yeah, that's why I do. I'm sorry. to me, it explained, you know, or it just made my obsession okay. It's like, okay, you're not completely crazy, you're fine, you know. This is okay. But that's a beautiful concept. You know, and as I was saying before, it's how the performing arts needs the audience, and how it's hard to understand that it's not that it's the applause that makes it work. It's that exchange, and how do you feel it? You know, that unspoken communication between the audience and the performer. I remember being as a performer coming off stage, you know, taking a bow, coming off stage, and you know, being asked a question like, "Oh, well, did they like it?" by someone, and I'm going, "Oh, yeah, I guess they did." I mean, I was bowing and they were applauding, and I was so. It wasn't the applause that I listened to as a performer. It was, you could feel that reaction from the audience, and it's lovely, and I always loved it. But it was more than that. That's not what told me whether that performance was successful or not. Because that's what's so wonderful about performing, is that there are levels of where you go and that magic moment, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's not technical reasons. It's not because, you know, you slipped or you fell, or sometimes it's those performances where you have fallen or have slipped that are the best. Because it's woken you up and something that's kicked in and it's gotten you on point and you're, you know, the razor's edge, doing exactly what you should be doing at that moment without your mind, without questioning, without the list saying what's next. You know, that flow happens. So, but that's not easy to attain. And for me, performing was that. It was definitely meditation. It was definitely meditation. It was a freedom from ordinary life. And I think it is for performers. It's a path to somewhere else. So I think Michael wanted me to talk about the process. I don't know what I do. I worry a lot sometimes. Before I have to choreograph something, I'm a wreck. My life is miserable for weeks before. I'm horrible to live with. My poor husband. You've not been released from your silence yet. But yeah, I don't know what I do. I mean, I have a lot of, you know, of course, the anticipation is terrible. Once you get into it, it's always much easier. But because it's like there is no answer. There is no way. I don't have a notebook with okay, if I do this and I do that, then everything's going to be fine. There's no book. Everyone has a different process. It's completely unique to each person. There's no answer. The only answer is to be true to yourself and to know what you want and what you need and to do it unquestioningly. I think. Because I know when I go into the studio to start the process or to continue the process of a work I've started, my preparation to go into the studio is very important. So I have to have done something. I have to meditate, I have to sit, I have to, you know, I've had to have quieted my mind, I've had to come to a place where I feel I'm tuned myself, you know, readied myself and done everything I could to get to be as centered as possible. And if that happens, then there's a chance of that flow happening and that day developing something. But it's interesting. I mean, it's complicated and it's simple. You know, you live the life you live doing the best you can and making yourself the best person. That's the most important, I think. And then you sit down and you do what you've trained yourself to do. I think that's the next important thing. It takes a lot of hard work to do what you're doing. I mean, a painter has to know how to paint. You know, and I feel if a painter chooses not to do something, it's a choice, not because they're incapable of doing it, because they don't have the training to do it. So vigorous training, I find to be very important, because you have to be ready to do whatever you want. Whatever you want. To really have creative capacity, you have to open your limits. There can be no limits. As a writer, you need to know language. You need to have a huge vocabulary. You need to understand grammar and the manipulation of words and their relationship. And you need vigorous training in whatever creative endeavor. So I think that's pretty basic. And then you need to work on yourself as a person. But Merce Cunningham, it was very sad. You know, New Year's Eve, we went to his last performance of his company because he passed away. Merce Cunningham is one of our great American choreographers of the century. Well, I should say the world, but he's American. And many of the great choreographers are American, so that's a really nice thing that we did, America, this century. And the company, they decided not to go on with the company after he passed because he didn't want new choreographers coming in and doing other work. And I just think the board of directors was a little concerned about keeping a company going with a repertory that, you know, you can't bring in new work. And I think they were wrong. And I hope that there's some revolution within the company. They bring it back because he has a vast, vast amount of repertory. The company could go on for many years. Have any of you seen Merce's work? Mm-hmm. You see, there's just a handful. I mean, that's what I mean. There's millions of people that haven't seen his repertory, and they should be given the opportunity, at least for the next, whatever, decade or, I don't know, something. Anyway, beside that, he was interviewed and asked a similar question, like your process and what do you do? And it's funny because Merce is thought of to be very intellectual. His partner was John Cage, which was a very vigorous composer. So there's some more information about what Cunningham's work is like. It's all about form, you know, and the conceptual things that bring it to be. And he really tried to strip it of emotion and realism and went the other direction, which is what happens in art. You know, people react against you've just done that really well, so what can I do? Where can I take that? Where is that going? And then the next generation, responds to that and brings that, all of that information up and transforms it and works on that. And so it keeps progressing. But he said to this interviewer, well, I don't know, I go into, and I'm sure this interview expected some complicated, intellectual, you know, comment about how his process and his thought and how he relates, you know, space to form and time and rhythm, you know, on it. And he simply said, well, I go into the studio and I put one foot in front of the other. We see what happens. That's basically what it comes down to. But of course, he had all that information. I mean, his life was working on all of that information throughout the day. But when it comes to the moment, you have to free yourself of all of those mind intellectual things, and you have to free yourself, and you have to act. And to act, it all has to come together, and body has to inform mind, and mind has to inform body, and that's what you guys are doing, right? So that's why I love coming here. So when I come into the studio, things go better for me. Things flow better. I feel really lucky because I was mentored by really wonderful, great choreographers in this century. you know, my first job was Agnes DeMille, who was a wonderful ballet choreographer, wonderful woman. Martha Graham, worked with her for years, did her roles. Laura Lubavitch and Palabolas, very specific, very different, all very different from each other. So I really feel lucky that I had the opportunity to work and learn from those people. And that is a great part of my process. Is that me making that noise? What am I doing? I was scratching my head. Maybe this is the next dance. Could be, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Anyway, what else do I have to say? So you have to be thankful. The process is informed, and it's a gift for many other people. I was given the gift to understand dance, to be able to be on the inside of it. It was a gift for many people. Many people that worked, devoted their lives to it, and I suppose reached there, that place from, again, it being passed on from other people. Another thing I feel about art and dance, and I hope this doesn't sound, my ear's itchy. Well, dance is, it's complicated. And it's a real history, especially in America. It's a wonderful history of people that have gone into doing it. And I the people that I've worked with, their processes were so different, so vastly different, that, I mean, mentoring myself, so sitting in the studio with Martha Graham for hours, watching her work, I would sit there as, I mean, I was a dancer and I would dance with her, but there are many hours when you're working on a piece that you're not actually there doing it, it's someone else, and you're, you know, sitting waiting. Watching, why did she make, why were those choices made? What was important to her at that moment? How did she choose to change it around and flip that? How did she respond? What was she responding to? So all of these things, trying to look at that and feel what she was doing, and then within my process think, well, what would I have done? Would I have made the same choice? Were the same things important to me? So I think within the creative process, it has to be, when we first started talking about it, you have to be true to yourself. You really do. You can't be imitative, and that's very hard to do because a work can really impress you. You can really go, I can't ever do anything that good. That was incredible. So how do you then go on and work? You're a unique voice. There's no two voices are the same. There's no two hands or voice or body that's going to make the same choice at the same moment. Never will be. So using those great works to have you view what's good, and just know, having that as a level of, they really committed. It was a real, you could see that person's soul in that moment. That's what you have to look at. I mean, for me, what I saw with Martha was her commitment. And her person was more of a lesson than any choice she ever made. The choices were useless to me because they were her choices. They should never be my choices. But what was informative was sharing time with that person and seeing that person and knowing that person and understanding how they continued. I mean, especially with dance and with writing as well, especially poetry. I mean, it's, you know, Martha always, it was always begging for money. It never ended. And she was a national treasure and the most renowned choreographer in America. No sport. There were weeks we didn't get paid. How did she, looking at that person and seeing that commitment, regardless of the recognition and the support that she should have had that she didn't have, and it doesn't matter, it just doesn't matter. It's interesting as a performer, or, well, I guess any creative person has reviews. You know, people come up to you when you, if you have a good review, and they get so excited, and that's wonderful. You have the endorsement, and they loved it. And it was, oh, especially my dancers, the performers, you know, that's another story. But the dancers can be, you know, influenced, and if you believe the good review, what are you going to do with the bad review? Because there's going to be a bad review. We can guarantee that. Everyone's not in favor all the time. You have your time, and then you don't have your time. And then you may have your time again. But it's never to be counted on, and never, certainly never to be a measure for what you're doing. So the story I was going to say, there was another story, was I had done a piece for Alvin Ailey had asked me to do a piece for his company, and I did a piece for the women. And it was a group piece, and the opening night came back, had a wonderful review. Yay, good. But the review went a little further than just saying it was good. They actually started to interpret what the dance was and talk about this and that. And I'm going, oh, well, that's very nice, but it has nothing to do with what I did, you know, at all. I came back, watched the performance that night, and they were doing the reviewer's piece. I went back, I said, wait, guys, what were we doing in the studio for 6 weeks? What are you doing? This is the piece, that's the piece we're doing, not her piece. She came one night, she saw it once. How could she possibly know it better than us? What are you doing? You know? So it's dangerous. I mean, so the creative process too, there's that, yes, you want to listen and understand criticism. I'm really bad at it though. I never believe anybody. But I did believe my father. The one critic I did have that I would believe was my father. If my father didn't like a piece I did, that was it. I said, okay, next, let's go on with it. And he was always right. There was just, you know, I hadn't gotten to the guts of it. He was always right. So, anyway, so keeping that third voice out of the process is very important. As a performer, it freezes you to have that. You're on stage and you're performing and suddenly you are there watching yourself. That's it, it's over. It's gonna be a bad performance. Because you're not in flow. You're watching yourself, you're disconnected. You're outside yourself. It's not you doing it, someone else doing it. So it's the same thing with the work, with outside criticism. You have to listen to it respectfully, but you can't. If you know that you did what you wanted to do, and they're just gonna have to look harder to see it or understand what it was. Because look at some artists, look at especially, you know, painters, long dead. Oh, that's what they were trying to do. Isn't it fabulous? Meanwhile, they starved to death with no one buying their work and not recognizing what they were doing. And so it happens all the time. So that can't be part of the process. It can't be recognition. It can't be because people love it. It has to be because it's what you have to do. Because it's your answer. It's your way of understanding, of going forward, of taking one more step forward.
so. And to have that, I think you really need to, you know, that's where the honesty comes in. You do it because you want to do it. Because you need to do it. Not ego thing telling you you should because isn't everyone else? So that's hard. That's very hard. It's very hard to see that. But here you are working on that. That's part of the process. So I think it all comes down to very simple, elemental things, as always, as it always does. So I'm going to break this silence now. And wonder if anyone has any answers to the questions I had, or if you have any questions for me or each other. So I don't know. So what were some of the questions I asked? Do you remember some of the questions I asked? Two, at least two, right? Oh, about the audience and why in performing arts was that audience so essential to know the value of the work?
That was a lovely circle. I love that. That was a dance.
I'll give that a shot, although that wasn't the one I was considering. First, I was considering you said something about why dance, like why are people compelled to move to rhythm at all?
Mm, right, that was a question.
And I was thinking, Bishop Michael was saying something the other day about how there's a theory that all rhythm is based on the heartbeat, and that the heart, you know, maybe your heartbeat's in something like 3/4 or 4/4, depending on the heart. It was interesting to consider that all movement must come from the fact that you can move at all. You
know? Right.
And that I don't know, I was thinking about that being the idea that we're compelled to move because we're compelled to move. You know, we have a heart that beats, that moves in rhythm.
But I guess so my next question is, why do we want to move so peculiarly? Because we can.
It's fun.
Because it's fun. Feels good.
Because I'm
good.
It feels good. Distraction and making a statement.
Yeah.
We want to conquer new realms.
It's free.
Yeah. It's free.
It's moving forward. It's easy. You don't want to do it anymore. You want to
right.
keep on looking for answers. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess dancing, it's interesting. I have heard that people with certain neurological impairments and so forth, they can't walk, but they can dance.
Mm-hmm. Also, it seems to me that perhaps the movement is to express things that can't be expressed in words. As you
that said. Certainly, yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking of the two hemispheres of the brain.
Oh, those, yeah. They give me a lot of trouble.
Generally stuck in our left brain, which is the monkey brain, and chatter, and analyzing and stuff. And in our right brain, I've just been reading a book about this, but in our right brain is more of a love center. And I'm thinking that dance, you can access your right brain.
Right. That's what's engaged. It's interesting because, unfortunately, I have a company. I say that unfortunately because I would just like someone to, I would just like to create dances without having to worry about getting the dancers, paying their salary, getting the insurance, renting the space, finding the theater, getting the light, you know, all of that stuff. And that's the other left part, is all of the logistics. And the right part is actually doing the important thing. I mean,
essential thing. And I find that it's really a problem for me, because if I find if I start, if I'm too much in that left hemisphere doing the logistics, the other part suffers. I don't go in the studio with it ready and flowing and available. It's okay. Because I've found myself thinking and working, exercising myself in another way that is counterproductive. So I just wanted to bring that up, that I definitely experienced that. Yes. Yes.
I feel like this might be common knowledge and I've just forgotten the answer, but do we know if any other animals dance? Or
yes, birds. Birds in Indonesia, I think that's where a lot of their dance came from. We just, my husband and I just saw a fabulous documentary. What were the birds called?
Birds of Paradise.
Yeah. Birds of Paradise in...
different species. Right.
The male performs fabulous dance. Yes. And the females are his audience. And the guys dance, and the females choose who they want. Great film. And the dance is wonderful. The bird gets on their toes, and the feathers spread out and become this like a tutu. Looks like a tutu. You know a tutu in ballet? Looks like a tutu, but it's higher and much more colorful. And, oh, it's a fabulous dance. And it looks very Indonesian, like he rocks his head. He does. It's unbelievable. It's, oh, you have to try and get it if you can. So, yeah. And where else did I hear anything else that danced? Yeah, birds dance. I think they're, you know, it's a mating thing. Yeah, dance is complicated.
Also, when Jane Goodall spent time with chimps, like occasionally after there would be families near each other, but they would never cross into each other's territories. But then, like once every few months, not any particular time, not with any particular set schedule, but two families would come together, and they would like put mud. Make a dance floor, basically, and not in any good dance beat, but some of them would be drumming, and then some of them would be dancing on the mud floor.
Wow. That's great. Yeah, the birds actually cleared out their performing space. They cleared, took things and cleared it. Oh, when they're migrating and flying? Yeah. So I think that movement and it's accessing something that we've forgotten or that we can't access any other way, because I think it's just deep in the cells. It's deep in the cell memory, and that our only path to it is this strange dancing to get there, to conjure up the memories of things we just can't do anymore with the other side of, or left side of the brain, maybe. Please do.
I love elegant ideas, and I'm a very conceptual thinker. And the way ideas develop for me are very much like a dance. And the only way that I can really allow those ideas to fully develop is to flow into them. And I've lived with a visual artist for 20 years, and I understand that he and I live in the world very differently. But I understand that our process is almost exactly the same. So for me, I think of things like Andy Goldworthy's art, or those speeded up time-lapse photography of flowers blooming, or lakes, things being created. And they all have that same flow, that sort of fractal opening. And for me, ideas, whether it's an idea, whether it's a conceptual form, an intellectual form, a physical form, a natural form, it all shares that same unfolding and flow, and finding its natural rhythm and space in the world. So there's not a separation. I mean, I feel like it's an expression of how the world evolves.
I wasn't giving it less of a, I was just saying within my process, it doesn't work. Whereas Cunningham, even though he did say that he put one foot in front of the other, in fact, there was a lot. He spent his morning with conceptual ideas, formulating and thinking through and planning. So certainly, I wasn't giving it a lesser, but you did good to defend it. In fact, all my friends are very smart intellectuals. They make up for my lack of use of my left side.
I think that there's a point where you navigate a lot through your mind. You understand through learning and spitting, repeating. And then there's just this moment, maybe as a little person, you look down and you realize you have all of this other parts of you, you know, skin and your fingers, and they move. And it's like you can navigate through space and through your world, not just with your mind, but, you know, you can shut that off and navigate through your sense of the derma, the skin on your body, or the sound of the amplifier becomes a new set of signals in which you can respond. And I think that's very freeing, that you don't have to, that your teacher becomes not just your mind, but becomes the sound or the shape of the space.
Right.
The way. So it's very nice to feel like, oh, I can do chicken dance, or I can do, you know, in it, it's Watusi or whatever. And it allows you to connect. And I think that's very, makes you feel expansive,
mm-hmm.
not limited.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the mind and body balance is very important. It's very important. It's all about, I mean, what Michael talks about is the Geshe Michael and the chakras and the two brains being one. You know, and the path being, I mean, it's very important, and it is all connected, and the whole point is to connect it and keep it connected and in flow. I think certain personalities, just as the uniqueness of people, you have different approaches how you get to that place, but it's all the same place that we're trying to get to, and they're equal with this very strong communication going, informing both. Because only then can the mind really work fully and the body if they're informing each other. Because we are here. there's no denying that we're here. You know, and sensation is how we are living through these forms. Yes.
And you dance also because you feel like you have something to celebrate. Because responding to rhythm makes sense. It's like a perfect moment.
Mm-hmm.
You feel useful, you feel like it has a purpose, that moment. But you also feel like to move in a better way, in a more aesthetic way when you dance, because you feel like there's something beyond to celebrate. You feel it inside, so that's why, at least why I dance.
Yeah. Yeah, that ritual thing that comes in. That inexplicable communication with what you can't understand. You know, it's beyond words at this point. Perhaps it won't always be beyond words. Maybe we will get there where we can actually articulate. I think some poets get pretty close. Yes. No, it's gotten worse as I get older. Oh, boy, has it gotten worse as I get older. No, but that's why I have my dancers around me. And I improvise with them, and we You got that? You know, I look around, okay, who has it? So it is a process. You can video yourself and then go back and learn what you, you know, look back and see what you like and use it that way. Because it's very hard to stop that process. That's a hard one. Because you lose the flow of where you are if you go back and, okay, what was that? I need to read. And then you sort of get stuck. And so it's a hard, it's a good question. So some people around that can help you with that, or set up a camera so you can just let it go and learn, go back and look at it, learn it. But also when you first start, because you're just beginning to develop your movement. So it's even harder because you do want to keep pushing through until you get past the points of old habits, things you've been trained to do, things you've seen a million times. You have to keep pushing through until you get past that and you start to get to, you know, the essential you. And that takes time. I used to recommend just improvising until you know, when you improvise and you keep moving and dancing, you know that lovely feeling when you start, everything starts to relax and you're not really thinking or worrying and your body's just moving and your mind is enjoying it. You know, you're really sort of accessing yourself choreographically to be able to get to that point is really good. Because then you're sort of getting to your, what's important to you in terms of movement and so forth. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was late. I finally fell asleep.
Oh, good.
This is my third dance. I just was listening to you and thinking about meditation as you were talking. You know, we're here studying how we can become more. How we can serve and open our heart, and how to meditate, which is very specific, you know, it's a skill. And I was listening to you talk about that, especially Michael talks about pianists or whatever, that we really have to develop the skill. But I was thinking for the first time when you were talking, actually someone said to me last night, there's also a flow, one of my teachers said, there's also a flow you have to find. And then I was thinking, you talked a lot about being a choreographer, but not about being a dancer and how to take somebody else's teaching or direction, and still you have to find your own voice. You know, like mm-hmm. I was an actor, and so, you know, you have to find your own voice. So I was thinking about that in relation to the practice of meditation, where you give yourself very specific things. And you mentioned meditation, so I'm just throwing out stuff.
Yeah. Well, let me respond to a few things because there's a lot there within that, those couple of sentences. I speak of myself as a choreographer because that's really the creative process, and I think that's what we were asked to concentrate on. The dancer made the choreographer. That's where the skill for movement came from the dancer. The choreographer then goes on and, as I was saying, tries to eliminate old habits, things that are root that you've learned from someone else, you were trained by someone else, to be able to rid yourself of that automatic response. As a choreographer, is I feel very important to find your unique voice. Did that make any sense? Because you do, as a performer, as an actor, a dancer, you're a tool. And you do everything you can to give that voice what they are asking you to give. So you become unimportant. Your choices don't matter. You're trying to figure out, how do I give this person what they want? How do I get... And that's your teacher. I mean, for me, they were my mentors, my teachers. Where the choreographers I chose to work with, and that's important because I just didn't work with anybody. I worked with choreographers I felt I was interested in, that could take me somewhere, that could teach me something.
So that's the, you know, so you make your choices about the information that you're training yourself in. But I was a tool as a dancer. All my mission was to give back to that person what they asked. I was not to make choices. Of course, you make, you know, you have to bring it to life as a performer and make it your own. That director or choreographer wants you to do that. They don't want you to be an automaton. You know, there's an exchange between the dancer and the choreographer when you're working on movement, you know, where they have to be in tune with you to interpret what you want and all of that. So that, you know, it's complicated. In that you have to have that information, that's your technical information, but then you have to be able to make it your own at some point and move on from there. And technique, I said technique's important, but technique is only important to free yourself. That's the only reason. If technique becomes the reason and the end all, you're stuck. You're not going to go anywhere. That's the end of the road. And I think that's the important part of that connection between the intellectual and the body, right? Because you can, and it happens both ways. I mean, you can get stuck in the intellectual and the ideas of what you're doing, the technique of it, which is very important. You have to be able to exercise and know and access those ideas and what they are. And as a novice, you have to work hard at it, and you have to do repetition, and you have to understand it. But once, the whole point is to free yourself. That's a good technique. A technique is not to lock you into something. It's to give you the skill to do whatever that thing you're trying to accomplish is in the best way you can. And to give yourself, as a painter, the surest hand. I've done this a million times. This is not, I know how to do this. I know how to mix. This is not my problem. I do this easily, mixing the paints, knowing what's going to happen. That's not the problem. I don't have to think about that anymore. I've practiced this. I have so much information. That's easy. Technique has to become easy. And then you forget about it and you move on. You can't get locked in technique. And that's a really difficult balance. And that's the balance between the idea and the body that has to happen.
Do you use visualization when you do your dances? In our meditation, we visualize.
I do when I meditate, but not when I dance. No, I can't really, not specifically. No, because the dance becomes the visualization, I'd have to say. You know, it's not, again, it's not that disconnect of the mind and the body. They're all doing the same thing. So the dance is the vision. That's the best way I can describe that.
You were talking about the relationship between the dancers and the choreographer. And I started thinking about your question about the audience and the dance a little bit differently. I had been thinking about the audience and the dancer. You know, as the audience being there so that you can shine, so that you, the dancer, or the dance itself, the choreography of the dance, have the visualization, can serve the audience. Learning to see in a more abstract light than usual. Without the audience, you don't get to give the gift, right? So the bigger the audience, the better. For this deeper reason than, you know, ticket sales, but rather just that you can then have more and more fertility.
Yeah.
I think that's a good answer. Maybe it's that simple. It's the gift of it that makes it work or not work. But the question I had, I agree, and that certainly, that gift is certainly a part of it, and for a performer, giving that moment, that work, that dedication as a gift is very, very important as satisfaction to the performer and enhancing who they are. And there's that other question I had, though, about why doesn't the creator know if it's a good work or not until it's shared with the audience? Because I think, is anyone else in the theater that does performing arts here? Do you agree with me on that, or am I making that up? Maybe it's me.
No,
I don't know.
The people I've worked with, the dance was, you work on the vocabulary for the piece, you work on the cues between yourselves and the lighting, but then it's basically like it's a live thing that, you know, like if you ever work with horses or animals, they're very, very sensitive. You can't, like, each person, we work together, but on that moment, depending on the temperature of the audience, they're also become a factor in the dance performance.
Mm-hmm.
Because dance is such a sensitive, very alive thing. It's like raw food. It's very alive and very sensitive to its environment. It's why it's, you know, depending on a small audience, your performance will completely change, you know,
right,
or whatever. We at performance, we had the performers were blind. The audience was blind. The performance was completely different.
The audience was blind?
Yeah, they sat on stage, so we had to perform a piece that was meant.
So they felt you?
Yeah, and so we were being conscious of our feet, and all of a sudden, a dance that we had done is very like up and down, you know, virtuosic, it was to Bach, was like this, like, foot shook down, you know, very different.
Yeah.
So you don't perform, you perform to your people.
Yeah,
it's
so it transforms it. Yeah.
It's a community. You want to feel like when you said that you lose yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When you feel that you've lost yourself and the others have perceived you, then you become one. And I think that's what's inspired me.
Right. Yeah.
When you're self-indulgent and they don't feel it,
right. Yeah, good answer. Thank you. Yeah.
Geshe Michael was speaking yesterday about how sometimes he adjusts, or a good teacher would adjust the teaching if they get a sense of what the audience, when they get a sense of what the audience truly means. And I think it reminded me of what Miriam was saying about the performance being a live thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not compromised by the needs of the audience, but somehow it's enhanced and informed. And performances have, like, change, different things come out. In fact, you're taught
right
actually what you're doing there.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I was looking at more from that point of view, from that self, from the stage point of view,
mm-hmm.
and that effect and how it all happened. Yes.
I have the great fortune to be married to an abstract artist, and so I find the whole discussion here quite interesting. One of the things that she always struggles with is she does a painting, and she probably does the painting 50 times, some of them, okay? And she struggles with when they're done. Like, how do you
know when it's done?
How do you know when you're done?
That's a good one. The first piece I did, it was done. And I went on and did a whole other section. That was twice as long as what it. And, you know, finally after looking at it for a few weeks, I think I even performed it a couple of times in the complete version, so to speak. I said, that's all for naught. The rest, it's done. At this moment, it's done. There's no reason to go on anymore. You've done it. The concept is there. Everyone knows what happened. You know, it's all there. All the information you had is there. Anything else is just diluting it. I don't know. I think that's instinct and intuition.
You are driven by a schedule to some extent, correct? You have to have something done at a certain time, and she doesn't.
Yeah, no, that's not what, no, because I can keep going. I mean, it's not the schedule that ends what I'm doing. I mean, I may not have finished the dance in time. That can happen. It doesn't usually, but it can, yeah. But it's not that I would end it because I'm out of time. So that's not a factor. I think that would be a factor, like with, I don't know, like Broadway shows. I've never done like a big production, you know, where the clock is ticking and the producer's breathing down your neck, you know. Okay, I'm done. It's done, you know, maybe. At a time, the union, you know, it's over. Time. I don't know. I don't work in those situations, but pretty much I just sort of feel a completeness and throw in the towel. And I'm pretty lazy too, so I like to say, ah, yeah, it's done, I'm finished. So that's a factor too.
I was just thinking that it's as if the dancer and the audience need each other, because the dance doesn't exist without the audience. And we talk in Buddhism about subject and object, that the object to exist needs the subject to perceive it. And the subject state of mind which perceives that object requires the object to be that subject state of mind. Mm-hmm. That they require each other so that there is a concept at all. And that things only exist in that union. And I feel like that about dance, but then I suppose that maybe there is some greater sophistication in the innermost circle in Bali, where the subject is something more esoteric
right.
than the audience.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Good information. Thank you. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
On that note, I played music, but it's hard to even say that because I rarely play for anybody else. And I feel like the only way I really know how to do it is in the inner circle. So, which leads me to my question, because that's where I've lived for 30-some years, and playing music in that way, and it's been a great celebration for me, it's worked for me. But now it doesn't. Like now I see that there has to be an evolution to it. And I guess I wonder, how do you own, you said you had a gift of understanding dance that came to you. And I just want to know how you own that, I guess, in some degree.
Well, with dance, it's more formalized. Because you have to study with someone. You have to go to a big room, to a school with a teacher. And it already gets thrown into the outer world pretty early on. right? I think you have to, I mean, for me, I looked at where I wanted to be. I looked at the choreographers I admired, or the teachers that I thought would inform me and bring me forward. So I looked for the people that would be able to bring me forward. And I just sat beside them. And I did whatever they wanted me to do. And it led to dancing. And usually, if that's what they do, if they're musicians or dance, I mean, that's what you wind up doing. So I think you have to look at the outer world, see what you admire and where you want to go. Who are your teachers? Who can give you the information that you need to move forward? And just put yourself beside them.
I'm also reminded of Anatole's presentation yesterday. Were you there? He talked about giving a banana. And the more you give a single banana, the more you'll be able to give, and the more the universe will let you give, and you'll be able to give more and more food, and create more and more, and give more and more.
This sounds like good advice. I do the banana thing. Yeah.
Today we there was a staff yoga in here today. So we were I forgot something. So I came in here and I think it was like a dance yoga class or something. I'm not sure what they were doing. But there was music. And it was Johnny O was leading it. And they were all like moving in this really beautiful way. Each person in their own way. And I sat back. We just sat back and I watched because I love watching it. I mean, I was conceived because my mother, because my dad could dance. That's this day, so she said, why did you like him? I just like the way he danced. So I just sat back and watched all of it, and there's some sort of because for me, dance scares me a little bit. There's some part of me that's still sort of, afraid. But to watch, this sort of, part of each person express itself was really incredible to watch them sort of because sometimes throughout the retreat, one person sort of eats their lunch alone a lot. You know, I've watched them, and they kind of have a certain way, but the minute they dance, it was like,
whole another person. Where did that person come from? Yeah. Again, you feel like that when you dance, right, Jenny-O? I mean, don't you become another person? Yeah? That shyness about dancing. You have to be able to play the fool as you dance. I mean, you have to have a real sense of humor about yourself and not take yourself too seriously, and you know, to not have that judgment about, oh, do I look cool doing this? No, you look like a fool. Yeah. Okay, great. I love that.
I think all of your questions kind of interrelate for me. I watched a program where a woman had a stroke, and there was a blood clot that blocked the entire left side of her brain. So she was only in the right side of her brain for 4 hours. And when that was finally fixed for her, she could express what that felt like. And she said being in the complete right side of her brain felt, she felt a very deep
hopefully. But yeah, that self-consciousness, it stops us from a lot, I think. Stops us from a lot. That's that third eye, or this third person looking, you know, it's self-consciousness. And it's not, it just prevents us from doing anything. It's not necessary. You mean for me, or within the piece itself, within the nature of the piece, or for my reaction?
And also when you see us perform.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Each piece, well, first of all, I try and have each piece be unique. So it's a whole nother world I'm entering each time. I mean, that's my goal. And it's always as if it's the first time I'm doing it. I mean, I've choreographed for many years. And every time, as I said, you know, before I go into creating a new work, I'm a mess and nervous and worried. And it's as if I've never done it before, every time. It's like, can you not get over this now? I mean, you've done this enough. Let's go. So, yeah. Yes. Oh, well, it wasn't like a clear break. When I first started choreographing, I continued to dance because I was maybe my early 30s when I started to choreograph. So I still danced. And then I just, because I tend to choreograph difficult works. So I just, at a certain point, I was about 46 or so, I said, I can't do full repertory anymore, not mine anyway. So I started to pull myself out, and I was still doing a little, you know, some stuff that I felt comfortable and still good about, but I couldn't do the whole repertory. So it was a natural progression.
Did that change for
you,
the experience?
No, not really. I didn't really mind giving up performing. I had performed enough, and it was very gradual, and it was my choice. It didn't change anything for me. I don't know why. There's some pieces. There's a couple of pieces I say, oh, that'd be fun to do. You know, but it's not a big deal. Because I know it would just not really be fun because I'd be in so much pain the next day.
What kind of music? I mean, you dance flamenco. Is the music that makes you or more like
fits
you?
No, it's I actually use contemporary choreographers, the music I work to. So contemporary classical, very often. Pretty unknown. You probably you've heard of Steve Reich, maybe. He's probably the most famous of all. They're all like undiscovered, wonderful composers. Well, maybe if David Van Tiegum, Glenn Branca, you can Google some of their names. They're interesting choreographers, classical, contemporary. Yes. A great student is with the teacher that they have chosen and believe in, first of all. Because a great student cannot question anything a teacher says. If they do, they have the wrong teacher. I mean, if you don't, you know, if you sit there and say, you mean what? What do I have to do that for? What do you mean? What do you mean by that? Work on it. You don't have to verbalize it. So you work on it. The lesson should resonate within you, and it should, you feel like, oh yeah, if I work on that, I will improve. You have to have that trust. If you don't have that trust, of course you don't understand it.
You have never done it before. It's new information. Of course you don't understand. Or of course you, no, darling, you can't do it. That's why you're here working. Right, so in a good student, a student that a teacher loves, takes their word with no question marks, with no, huh, well, why, well, how? Practice it till you start to understand. You can't expect to know what a teacher's talking about. Otherwise, you'd be their teacher. Why are you here? Right? That's a great, that's all a teacher wants, is a student that takes the information they're given, the student takes it and works on it, and works on it till it's theirs and they understand it. And every student's different. I mean, it takes some people longer, some less. That doesn't make for a teacher a great student or a bad student. If someone takes twice as long to get something, it doesn't, in my eyes, make them less. Because I see that what they may reach a higher level than the one that gets it instantly. So that doesn't make you a good student or a bad student. How long it's taking you, none of that matters. The information, what matters is that you want that information and you're going to do anything you can to get it and make it yours. You're very pregnant. When are you due, actually? What is your due date?
It looks like I'm due today, but...
Yeah, you're like dropped. I'm walking, watching her walk, and it's like, oh, that's dropped. Thank you. That's very sweet. That's very sweet. Thank you. Thank you. Well, so we do have dance classes coming up. We'll see what we can do this year. I will try my best. You're a great group. I'm sure we'll have fun. And we won't worry about the outcome. The process. I'm always saying it's the process, not the outcome. That's what we'll look at. And we'll try and, you know, have fun, do a little something. I have no idea what, but we'll figure it out. We'll come up with something. It's like we'll put one foot in front of the other and see what happens. You were all great and great questions. I learned a lot. Thank you a lot. Thanks.